I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we look at three films being screened as part of this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. We begin with the film Harry and Snowman. It's the true story of a plow horse destined for the meat market who became a show jumping champion in the 1950s with his owner and rider, Harry Dallaire. Joining us on the phone is Ron Davis, director and producer of Harry and the Snowman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ron, the story of Snowman is a pretty remarkable one, and some listeners might be familiar with the book $80 Champion, Snowman, the Horse That Inspired a Nation by Elizabeth Letts. When did you first come across the story of Snowman, and why did you decide to make a film about this horse and his owner?
Well, I came across the story when most people did, when the book came out. Now, I knew who Harry Dallaire was because I used to ride as a child, and I knew the galloping grandfather when he was, you know, in his later years, showman. So I knew him, but I just didn't know the beginnings. And when the book came out, I remember people bringing it to my attention, and I thought, oh, that's a nice story. It's a, you know, sweet story. But I didn't really, I was in the middle of another project. It didn't really jump off the screen to me. But when the paperback came out and it hit the number one bestseller again, a friend said, you've got to look at this story. And really, it's magical, and it's a Cinderella story. And I thought, you know, and it just hit my heart, and I thought, this is a movie that I think I can get made and that I know people will go and watch.
Mm. All right, we're going to hear a clip from the film, and we're going to hear the voice of Harry, the Dutch immigrant who found Snowman at an auction in Pennsylvania.
I got a flat tire on the way to the auction, and the sale was about over when I got there. And they were loading all the horses to go to the slaughterhouse. And then I see the van with the horses to be killed for dog meat. The guy who did the slaughterhouse, he killed the horses and took it to New York to the pet stores and sold the meat to them. There was a white Amish plow horse on the van. The same time I looked at him, he looked down to me. And that's why he and I connected. And I said, that horse could be a very nice horse. Then I asked him to take him off the truck that I could see him. I could see he got a mark on the shoulder where he was pulling a cart or a plow or something. He only got one shoe on him. He did not try to bite, or he did not try to kick. He did not try to do anything. He just stood there dead quiet.
Ron, tell us more about Harry.
Harry Dallaire, you know, it's hard to wrap him up in one word. He's a really dynamic individual. He's a showman. He is someone who is dedicated to his family, but on the opposite side of it, his love and his connection with horses at some levels compromised some of the close relationships in his family, the relationships that he had with his family. So he's a complicated man, like most people are.
Mm. Now, as we saw, Harry finds Snowman at this auction. He brings him home as a school horse for students at the Knox School, which is an elite girls' school on Long Island, where he is a riding instructor. So when does he realize that Snowman has potential to become much more than a school horse?
Well, it took a while because he bought Snowman literally he said he wanted a horse that would carry around the girls that were not so talented, as he puts it, quiet and safe. And Snowman did that for an entire year. And at the end of that school year, as a lot of horsemen did, they would sell the school horses so they didn't have to feed them all summer. So he sold Snowman and to a farmer about 7 miles away. And Snowman didn't like that and jumped out of his field and came home 7 miles on multiple occasions. No matter what they tried to do to the horse, they tried raising the fences. It didn't help. They actually tied a rope with a tire to it so that he could sort of graze, but theoretically not jump out of them. He jumped out with the tire, and the new owner finally said, you got to buy this horse back. He does not want to be with me. He wants to be with you. And Harry, the light went off in Harry's head, and he went, oh, my God, this horse can jump, and jump in a way that he could never imagine. So they started training him to become a show jumper.
Yeah. For those who aren't familiar with show jumping, can you explain what the horse and rider have to accomplish?
Sure. Back in the 50s and in the 60s, the show jumping was about jumping really high. Who could go the highest without any fault, without knocking things down? So they'd all go in and say, jump maybe a 5-foot course of jumps. And the horses that went clear and didn't knock anything down or didn't touch anything would come back for another round, and they'd raise the jumps. And they, each round, they would keep raising the jumps until there was a winner. So Snowman had to jump the highest, and he had to jump the cleanest. He couldn't even touch the rails. And in certain classes, there was even speed where you had to be, if there was a tie, it was who went the fastest.
And, of course, Snowman was an amazing jumper, and for a fairly long period of time, he held the high jump record and even would jump over other horses if asked. Yet at the same time, he was bomb-proof. Even the most novice rider could get on him. An unusual combination in a horse.
Very unusual. Nowadays, you would never see a Grand Prix-level horse as a school horse with beginners on him, or swimming around in the Long Island Sound with kids on him, or pulling a sleigh, or none of that stuff would be happening because they'd be so pampered. But Snowman really was, like you said, bomb-proof. And he was, the movie is not about this champion. It's about this horse that became an integral part of this family.
Mm. Yeah, your film includes archival footage of Snowman, both in the show ring and at home with the Dallaire family. Where did that footage come from? And do you know how common it was for people to be making home movies in the 1950s?
It was very uncommon to have home movies and to have film of a horse or of anybody back in the 50s. I mean, it was very uncommon. The only reason we could find so much about Snowman, because he was so famous. He's the most famous story that nobody knows about.
Right.
I mean, if you think about the 50s, there were, four television stations that all didn't start till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Snowman was on 2 or 3 television shows. He was in Life magazine. He toured around the world. They flew him to Europe. They took him on boats to Bermuda. I mean, they were really famous. So we were able to find a great deal of footage. Also, the Dallaires had a lot of their own footage. So it was a lot. It was easy. I don't want to say it was really easy, but it was easy to find Snowman. As an example, the huge thoroughbred top-of-the-line jumpers, the best elite in the country, we couldn't find all but 2 pictures of them.
Wow.
The ones that he beat.
Oh,
that's
wow.
How famous he was. We found 1,200 photos of Snowman. We found 2 of any of his competitors.
That's amazing. Now, despite his growing fame on the show jumping circuit, Snowman, as you're saying, was still very much part of the Dallaire family. And we have another clip from the film about the Dallaire children swimming with him, and we'll hear the voice of Harriet Dallaire talking with her father, Harry.
Snowman loved to swim. And you put me on, and I thought I was going to Connecticut because I was only 9 years old. I just kept going, okay, he's not going to turn around. How am I going to get turned around and get back to shore? You put your fingers in your mouth, right? Whistled,
yep.
And Snowman turned his head, and we came back to shore.
Yeah, that's the way they did it. They use him as a diving board. They stand on him and dive off him. It was a little ridiculous the way they use him, but he was a family horse.
So Harry and his wife, Joanna, had a large family, and all the children were very much part of the family business of running a horse barn and competing on the show circuit. But the success of Harry Dallaire did come at a price, and you mentioned that. We hear in the film that oftentimes it was hard to beat Harry Dallaire's child. So talk more about the impact of his success on his family.
You're right. You mentioned briefly that the kids all were an integral part of the business. And one of the kids talks about it in the film where she says, we had to win because we were their dad's calling card. If he couldn't get his kids to win in the ring, how is anyone going to bring their children to him to learn to ride and go to horse shows and win? So there was a tremendous amount of pressure on those kids. And then as they got older, as the boys, especially the boys, started coming into their late teens, they now are getting out of the junior divisions and we're starting to have to compete against their dad, who was extremely competitive and liked to be in the limelight. And, a couple of the kids found it or they all found it quite difficult, and one had made a choice to actually leave early and go, you know, get away from it and go start his own business.
Harry and Snowman make it all the way to the National Horse Show at Madison Square Garden in New York City. And this is the pinnacle of the show jumping world. And the two won it not once, but twice. They both became overnight celebrities. So tell us how the country responded to their wins at the National Horse Show.
Oh, the country responded overwhelmingly. I mean, they were in the national news. They were in the newspapers across the country. They were the Seabiscuit or the Secretariat news story of their day. And, you know, maybe if there wasn't a movie about Seabiscuit, nobody would know who he is. Mm-hmm. But they were at that famous at the time. And I got emails as we were making the film from people who would say, oh, I have a photo or I have something that my dad had kept about Snowman. You know, would you like to see it? And when I would correspond and say, oh, was your dad a rider? They said, no, he didn't have anything to do with horses. He just loved Snowman and he loved the story, and so he followed it.
I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned the 1,200 or so photos that you found of Snowman and only two of two other horses. Part of it, I think, might be the story. Here he was, you know, on this meat truck ready to be, you know, turned into dog food, and he gets rescued. And then this unusual combination of him, you know, being the diving board for the kids, you know, as well as this amazing show horse. I mean, this really was a great story.
It's the true Cinderella story that everybody wishes would come true. And in this particular case, it really did at every level. The Dutch immigrant who came to this country with nothing to try to make something of himself and, you know, lands here as a sharecropper on a tobacco farm, finds a horse who's about 2 hours away from being turned into dog food. And together, they went on to greatness and, you know, the horse made Harry, and Harry made the horse. He gave the Snowman the ability and the chance to be a part of a family and to be loved. And in return, he gave Harry this huge start for his career that launched him.
Yeah. Harry retires Snowman from the show jumping circuit in a moving ceremony at Madison Square Garden. And Snowman spends the rest of his life on the Dallaire farm. Even though Snowman died many years ago, Harry still gets emotional when he talks about him.
He gets very emotional. Harry is someone who keeps his emotions to inside. He doesn't share them. So he doesn't like to talk about the war. He doesn't like to talk about death. And for him, the death of his animals was extremely painful. And he hasn't talked about it. So for the first time in many years, I was there really trying to get underneath it. And it comes right to the surface with him when you talk about Snowman and what he meant and who he was, and not just about the career, but what he really gets choked up on is who he was to the family, and who he was to his kids. And even the kids say, when he died, it was like losing a parent. Mm. That's how close and how integrated this horse was to their lives.
Yeah. It's such a unique bond, you know, with the family, but especially Harry. You know, we all have bonds with animals in our lives, but this just seems like such a unique one.
It's completely unique. It's one that you see usually only in the movies, and those movies are fictionalized. And you hope and dream that, you know, you might be able to have one. And Harry and his family had it right there.
What were the challenges in putting this together? Sounds like, you know, you had the photos, you had the films, you had the family. So were there many challenges when you put this film together?
There actually are challenges with every documentary. And every, you know, I've not done a feature, but with the documentary, the challenge here was that we were trying to tell the story of a man's life that spanned 88 years and incorporate that with the Snowman story, which really only took place, the height of it, for 4 years. So the challenge is, how do you keep Snowman alive throughout an entire film when he was such, you know, from a time perspective, years, a small part of this man's entire life? Mm-hmm. And that was challenging. It was very challenging.
Yeah, a small part, but such an important part. Yeah,
I think we did it.
Yeah. Well, the film is Harry and Snowman, part of the Woods Hole Film Festival. We'll have screening information at our website, capeandislands.org. Director and producer Ron Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Coming up after a break, Circus Without Borders. Two young acrobats from remote corners of the globe dream of bringing hope and change to their struggling communities through circus. You're listening to The Point. Today we're discussing films in this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. Circus Without Borders is a documentary about two young acrobats from remote corners of the globe who dream of bringing hope and change to their struggling communities through circus. Joining us is Linda Matchin, the producer, and Susan Gray, who's the director of the film. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The film centers on two characters and two regions. Guillaume is Canadian, working with an Inuit community in Canada, and Yamusa is from Guinea on the west coast of Africa. These two regions are vastly different. One is in the Arctic, the other near the equator, but the communities both are struggling. So let's start with Guillaume and is Igloowik, did I pronounce that name right, in the Arctic. Describe the community.
Igloowik is a pretty barren community. It's an island of about a little over 2,000 people. Like many of the Inuit communities in the Canadian settlement region of Nunavut, it's very poor. There are a lot of social problems. Very rich in history, very rich in culture. But there's been a disconnection with the history and culture that goes back to the days in which the Canadian government resettled the Inuit from their nomadic existence and put them in communities scattered about the Canadian North. So there are still people who hunt and who fish, but it's hard, it's expensive to afford the equipment. And a lot of the young people have lost that tradition. There are schools up there, and kids do get educations, but a lot of them don't stay in school. And some of the social problems for young people include, drug use and alcoholism, and a particular problem, which was really the impetus for this film, which is suicide. Mm.
Then we have Guinea, former French colony, and while it's now independent, there is also extreme poverty and very little opportunity for people. So how did Yamusa find his way into acrobatics and then out of Guinea?
Yamusa was sort of discovered as a kid. He was a street kid. His mother sold bread. And a French film director came to France and wanted to make a film about acrobatics and circus. His name is Laurent Chevalier. He's in the film. And he created a circus called Cirque Baobao. And the sort of the history of Guinea is that it was one of the first French colonies to declare independence from France. And de Gaulle angrily wanted to get back and told the world not to trade. So they turned towards the Eastern Bloc, towards China and towards Russia. And they really became magnificent acrobats. They were trained in a sort of very strict way using the dance and the traditions that they already had in Guinea. And so Yamusa came into the circus and he really stood out. And he was then accepted into circuses overseas. He got into a Spanish circus and eventually found his way to a circus in Montreal, Cirque Oise, and that's where he met Guillaume.
I'm going to play a clip from the film that describes when Guillaume and Yamusa first met. We'll hear the voice of Guillaume first.
Since the first day, I heard that there was a great acrobat from Guinea who was amazing. We didn't even shake hands, nothing. We started to do acrobatics together, and that was awesome. Instant bond. He started telling me he has his dream of going back to Guinea, start working with his brothers, try to bring other friends, family. And I was telling him, amen. That's exactly what I'm doing in the Arctic.
We just discovered we have the same dream, helping kids through circus.
We're asking all the youth, share who you are, be generous, and everything will come.
Share who you are, be generous, and everything will come. That's really a message that goes beyond becoming an acrobat and a performer.
It's very beautiful, isn't it?
I think it is.
It could be the mantra of people in any part of the world, in any stage of life. We personally found it very inspiring for ourselves.
Yeah. I love how they met. They didn't shake hands. They just did acrobats together. It's, sort of like these kindred spirits.
Exactly right. Yeah. They do consider themselves brothers.
Yeah. I'd like to play a clip from the film of when we hear the traditional Inuit throat singing. And during the singing, what we can't see is the circus troupe performing a series of acrobatics and dance moves. But let's listen.
Throat singing is over 2,000 years old. When the church went up north, they said it was a form of devil worship. All the women were forbidden to practice it, perform it, teach it. But the younger generation is bringing it back.
For such a long time, we have been misunderstood. This will show who we are, where we come from, and how we have survived, you know, from ancient times to today.
You know, Guillaume's Circus is very much about reconnecting the Inuit with their culture and tradition and also sharing those with the larger world. You spent a lot of time with Guillaume and the performers. Can you describe the impact of the circus on the Igloolik community?
Yeah, that was a really great choice of clips. You really hear in that clip the exotic music that comes from the north, and then you hear the modern music that follows, and that's sort of what Art Circus is all about. Guillaume has brought them out and taught them hunting, which has been lost for many members of the troupe. And he's taught them throat singing and these other parts of their culture that were lost that, you know, for us is very surprising. And what he's found is that as the performers sort of turn towards the West, just like everybody else is watching their iPods or, you know, television, all of that, they sort of forget who they are. So his idea is you take them out and you have them remember their roots, their traditions. They get strong in their own culture and self-confident. You go out on the world stage and you see them get recognition on the world stage for being Inuit and for knowing their traditions, and you bring that back to the community. And that's exactly what they've done. And now they don't really want to travel the world, and that's what you see at the end of the film. They want to come home and help their community and their kids and the next generation. And you know, in this group of people, you'll see over the course of the film, they weren't successful in ending suicide, which is why the whole circus was started in the beginning. It was a problem they were having up north. But they were successful in building a community to support each other for when it happens and to keep going. And, you know, the hope is that there will be less and less in the future as they do their work back home.
Guillaume Circus travels, you find yourself wondering if the young Inuit will find it difficult to return home once they're introduced to this larger world. And as you mentioned, that question is answered later in the film by one of the young performers who says she loves to travel, but she loves to come home.
So, right. It's very counterintuitive. I think we all tend to think of a success as making it in the large stage. That clip that we heard was actually during a rehearsal for the Vancouver Olympics, where they performed, you know, in front of thousands and thousands of people. But that's not their definition of what success is. And it took a while for at least me personally to really understand and appreciate that. Their definition of success is coming back home and helping their community and enriching their community through some of the things that they've learned by passing on some of the skills that they've absorbed. And by helping other people understand that there's a larger world out there, but that their world is a very beautiful world and they shouldn't try to change it or run away.
Let's shift to Yamusa's story. He finds his way out of Guinea because, as we mentioned before, he's such an accomplished acrobat. He's given an opportunity to bring other Guineans to his circus. Let's hear another clip from the film. The voices are of the founder and the director of Cavalia, a circus that includes horse. And in the background, we'll hear Yamusa singing and playing an instrument.
We were dismantling in Montreal. I have a friend who was helping as a technician. And I was having a discussion with him, and I said, well, I'm looking for guys who can do strap, and I was explaining what kind of discipline. And he said, well, actually, I have one of the best acrobats in the world right here helping me to work and dismantling the tent.
I'm
I auditioned Yamusa, and I found him as this unbelievable performer, great musician, great singer. And I told him right away, I said, you have a job. Do you have any brothers?
I fell in love with his voice. I said to Norman, I said, this guy has such a beautiful quality that we should have it in the show.
Yamusa started to tell me his story about being involved with the circus school and all those acrobats in Guinea. And that stuck to my mind, and since then we're trying to get the Guinean to come to Cavalier.
Well, I spent 5 days in Guinea auditioning acrobats on a beach with rubbish, garbage everywhere, broken boats.
Yamusa feels the pressure of finding 10 acrobats to bring to Cavalier, but 1,000 show up for the audition on the beach, and the tenacity and drive of these youngsters is amazing.
It's true, yeah. It's what we felt personally. We were in Guinea watching what we felt were world-class acrobats. Yamusa began a school, so he's going back between performing in Montreal to train kids. And when we were there, there were so many problems with the government. They were having the first elections in 23 years, that there was a military state of emergency with gunfire on every corner. And we just left the country thinking, these kids are never going to get out. Mm. 3 months later, the recruiter for this huge circus, Cavalier, it came to Boston, actually. They performed in Boston. Goes to Guinea and recruits 10 kids. And they get out and they start performing all over the world. It was really Yamusa's dream. And there's a really beautiful scene in the film where Yamusa is talking to the kids and he's telling them this has been his whole life's dream, is to get others out of Guinea, to not be alone. And he starts crying. It was really the first time we really saw through Yamusa's act of being so tough. And he describes how difficult it was for him leaving alone. And now it's going to be hard for everybody else, but they're together and they just need to work hard and they'll make it.
Yeah. They bring the acrobats that were chosen from the beach audition to join the show. And there's a scene in the film where Yamusa is introducing the young men to the apartment where they'll be living, how the light switches work, the refrigerator. And more importantly, he advises them on the reality of being men of color in a white country and some of the pitfalls of having money at their disposal. It's quite an education for these young men.
It is. It was a great scene because he's speaking to them in their native, in their dialect, which is Susu, and we had a cameraman there shooting this whole thing. And of course, we had no idea what they were saying. We were sort of joking afterwards that they were talking, you know, maybe they were talking about you do 3 backflips and, you know, 6 somersaults. And then we brought the film back and had a Susu translator kind of unwrap it for us. And it was such a gift to find out what he was really. What he was really saying, we just couldn't possibly have known.
Mm, yeah. Now, the Inuit Circus makes the trip to Guinea to meet Yamusa's acrobats. Describe how the trip came about and what it was like when those two groups met.
This had been a longtime dream of Guillaume ever since he met Yamusa at Cirque Elwaz in Montreal. He'd always included Yamusa in his family, and he wanted to go back to Guinea and meet Yamusa's mother. So they got a grant. They were bringing everybody in, and they got, because of the military state of emergency, stuck actually in Paris for a week. And when they finally got there, there was this huge moment of joy when everybody met each other, and you could just see the Inuit were sweating away. It was so hot for them. And the Ghanaians immediately did a celebration with all the dancing and the music and contortionists. And you see the Inuit looking at the contortionists with a look of sort of horror, like, look at them, it's scary. But it was really great because there's a little scene where the Ghanaians, who are such outstanding acrobats, are trying to do a simple little game that they do in the Arctic, which is called kick the seal. And they couldn't do it. They couldn't get their legs up high enough to kick the seal. And the Inuit are sort of laughing that they can't pull it off.
This film was 7 years in the making. So, how did you come across the story of these two circuses?
We came across the story of one circus initially. I'm a reporter at the Boston Globe, and it started out as a travel story that I was doing for the Globe back in 2006. And it was a story about something completely different, about artists in the Canadian North. And just by chance, I happened to go on a little side trip to a community called Pangnirtung to do a hike because there's a beautiful national park there. Very small community. And while I was there, it happened that there was a suicide that had taken place. A young woman had killed herself, leaving two little girls behind. And it was beyond tragic. It was just a horrible scene. You could see the community just brought to its knees by this. And that led me to think more about and to try to learn more about why suicide was a problem up in the north. And that led to some research that told me about ArtCirc. They were there was an article about them in a Canadian newspaper as a circus performing arts troupe that was trying to help deal with the suicide problem. So the initial focus of the film was on ArtCirc alone, and then we came to learn about Guillaume's relationship with Yamusa and this trip they'd planned that they've been so excited about to Africa. So we followed them there. And one thing led to another, and over a period of time, the story unfolded.
Mm. And what were some of the challenges of filming on location in both the Arctic and Guinea?
Let's see. That's an excellent question. One of the major challenges is actually getting up there or getting down there. It's really expensive, and we were finding ourselves trying to raise the money at the same time we were trying to chase the story that kept unfolding. The first time we really went up for a shoot up in the Arctic, we landed with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that had come into town to take hearing on the residential schools in Iglulik. And we got really great footage while we were there about the residential schools and what had gone on, but it was difficult because for the days following that, all of the members of the troop were sort of in mourning about what had come out during the TRC hearings, and so it was difficult to get access to the characters. Mm. In Guinea, as I said before, in Guinea when we went down, there was the first elections in 23 years and a military state of emergency. So we were not allowed to take the camera out of the backpack because they didn't want any journalists there. Mm. And we basically did the whole shoot with one camera. The poor camera guy was also doing sound. We didn't have a lot of electricity because we kept losing electricity. Mm. So we were trying to charge the batteries every time the lights came on, which would happen any time, day or night. And it was hard to get off the compound with a camera. And at one point, we actually took a picture of the palace and a military truck and almost ended up being thrown in prison for it. And here we're trying to make a simple story about a circus.
Well, the film is Circus Without Borders. It's part of this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. We'll have screening information on our website, capeandislands.org. Linda Matchin, producer, and Susan Gray, director, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after break, Women of 69 Unboxed, a film that asks women from the graduating class of 1969 to reflect on the course of their lives. You're listening to The Point. We are discussing three of the films in this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. The 1960s was a decade that marked major shifts in our country's political, civil, and social landscape. For individuals coming of age, it was a tricky landscape to navigate, particularly for women. The societal norms of previous generations when women were primarily wives and mothers were dissolving while new roles were both evolving and being challenged. Women of 69 Unboxed is a documentary in this year's Woods Hole Film Festival that asks women from the graduating class of 1969 to reflect on the course of their lives, the choices they made, and the challenges they faced. Joining us on the phone is Peter Barton, director and producer of the film. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Thank you.
And Liz Roman-Galise, executive producer. Thank you, Liz, for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Peter, the title of the film is a reference to the graduating class of Skidmore College in 1969. Back then, Skidmore was a women's college, and instead of putting together a yearbook, the women put together a year box. Can you explain what a year box is?
Yes, the women decided that they would pose themselves. They would be their own directors for their own photo shoot. And those photos were very creative, very iconoclastic. They decided also that those photos would not be bound in a book, but they'd be in a box, loose leaf, so that you could take them out, put them on the wall. You could take your enemies and throw them away. You could focus on just a few photos or all of them. So there's a lot of choice, and that choice reflected the spirit of the times, and the choices that women were facing going on into the 70s and 80s, which were not easy for them. It seems like freedom would be simple, and you just go forward, figure out what you wanted to do, but freedom was not so free. It was not so easy to make those choices.
And Liz, you're the executive producer of the film and a member of Skidmore's College Class of 1969. So tell us about your portrait in the yearbox.
Yes, I am. I'd always loved the yearbox. I remember getting my copy upon graduation, keeping it on the shelf for decades and decades, looking at it occasionally, reflecting on it often, and deciding it would be a tremendous device through which it should be brought to life in a documentary. My own photo is set against a broad window on the upper landing of an old Victorian mansion. I'm holding a candle. I'm in the shadows. You see about half of my face, not the other half.
So you're sort of this idea to track down your classmates and record their observations about their lives. Did that come from you, Liz?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, Peter, how did you get involved?
Liz's classmate, Jane Starts, is my wife.
Oh, okay.
Liz came to Jane, who's one of our three producers, with this idea. Jane's not really a documentarian, and so bounced Liz to me. I had done a woman's liberation movie back in the late 60s, early 70s, with three other women. And so I had a history in this area and an ongoing interest in women's issues.
Yeah. So, Liz, you're looking, as you said, you had this box, you know, with all these photos, and you're kind of looking through them. Was it your curiosity, wondering what happened to these women, that prompted you to try to track them down?
Absolutely. Certainly the issue of what happened to them was a very intriguing one, because choices were wide open for women as a result of the 1960s movements. So it was just a natural next step to figure out, all right, with all these choices, what did the women make of them?
Mm. Well, prior to the 1960s and 70s, women were expected to marry, have children, regardless if or where they went to college. And the subject of sex was taboo. Ladies didn't talk about it, and they certainly didn't do it before marriage. Here's a clip from the film I'd like to play that describes this time.
Everybody came home from Christmas senior year with their rings.
Sex was never a conversation at home.
And she says to me, "Do you know what a diaphragm is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's this muscle."
Finally, an enlightened gynecologist came to town, and he let it be known that he would give birth control to women who were engaged. One of my students sent away for her older sister's engagement ring. She put it on, went to see the doctor. And the doctor, years later, said to me, "Tom, if I saw that ring once, I saw it 27 times. That's what women had to do in that era to get a hold of birth control.
The ring by spring thing was nonsense. I never heard that before. That was not on my agenda. My mom had told me early on, if you want to get married, stay home and save everybody a lot of money.
I think I was interested in romance from the time I was about 4. This little boy named Georgie Kiefer gave me a ring. That was the beginning of the end for me.
I think everybody wanted to appear to be a virgin, and I think everybody said they were a virgin. I actually restored my virginity after high school. I then became... I was a recovering virgin.
College was largely seen as a place for women to meet their husband, and many of the Skidmore class of 1969 did just that. Yet they also wanted more. Liz, can you describe how these women felt?
I think that you see a split in the class. Certainly there were a set of women who were at school for their MRS degree as well as their BA or BS. But as the years went on, from 65 to 69, it became increasingly apparent that if we wanted, we could possibly have more than that. So there were a number of us, I believe, who embraced the new reality and decided to go for something beyond wife, mother, homemaker.
Peter, today adolescence and early adulthood is often marked by a feeling of being adrift, of struggling to find oneself, something similar to what these women describe. Do you think that's partially attributable to the dismantling of roles and expectations for both men and women that came about in the 1960s and 70s?
I think that's true. I think the 60s remains with us today. Those choices continue to broaden, but they're not easier for young people to make. I got involved in part in this project because I showed this movie that I did in 1971 to an audience that included a bunch of young women. They didn't seem to relate, and that really upset me because I felt that those struggles were ongoing, and that those decisions by young women are still tough for them. They have more choices, but it doesn't make it easier necessarily.
Yeah. I'd like to play another clip from the film that speaks directly to the stress and tension created when trying to juggle family and career.
I was fortunate because my husband worked freelance and he was at home, fortunate, unfortunate, because at a certain point I felt somewhat resentful that here I was being the person to go to work every day and basically bring home the bacon. Wasn't it great? I was a successful woman of the 70s, but I worried that my children's major attachment was to my husband, who was really taking the role of the traditional stay-at-home parent, and I was bravely marching into the workforce to come home exhausted all the time and have the feeling that, you know, I was somehow failing at my work because I wasn't there as much as I should be, and I was failing at home because I wasn't with my children.
The schools didn't have an all-day kindergarten, so it really became an option for me where I could just drop the kids off in the morning and pick them up at night. And I can remember both of them standing behind this fence crying as I'm leaving. It was just, it was devastating, absolutely awful. Awful.
Women had to work twice as hard. And this has been documented by double-blind studies of resumes and publications and, you know, fellowship grants that women's have to be, you know, half again as good to get an equal outcome.
Assertiveness in women is aggression. It's okay for guys, but it's not okay for women.
And he asked me the question, and it was on the evening news. I'd love to try to find this footage. And he asked me the question, why you, right? Why, you know, I was pretty young, you're so many years old, and, you know, why would he have chosen you for this job? And I said, would you ask that question of a man? And I think I caught him off guard.
They were all men except for me. And we had a 7 o'clock breakfast meeting once a week. And I remember, you know, I was like a stopwatch, getting everybody ready, dropping off at childcare, et cetera, et cetera. And so I went in to get Danny, and he had made just a huge mess in his crib. I had to give him a bath. I'm looking at my watch, 6:45, saying to myself at the time, there's not a single member of the executive committee doing this morning, that's for sure. You know, I remember being kind of annoyed that, you know, there was no opportunity for me to even catch a breath because they were running it like a men's club.
Mm. What strikes me about the clip is that working women today face those same challenges, having ambition perceived as aggression, having to produce work that's of a higher caliber than men, and balancing career with family. What do you hear from the women of 1969 about how the working world for women of today compares to the 1970s or 1980s?
I don't think it's all that much easier. I suspect you, Mindy, face some of those same challenges.
Sure.
And tough decisions. I'm sure you've heard recently the phrase, the war on women. I think there's a lot of pushback against the advances that women have made, and having more choices doesn't necessarily mean that those are easier choices.
Liz, you agree?
I do, and I believe that the women whose voices we've just heard in those clips were among the first of a generation trying to figure out how to do it.
It's easy enough to say, okay, the opportunities are now open to you. But when it came down to actually making the reality work in day-to-day life, that was something else entirely. It had to be learned, and it had to be experimented with through trial and error, decision by decision, decade by decade.
Mm. One of the women in the film is an African-American who becomes very successful in her career but never has a family. In fact, her mother told her if she was going to go to get married, she could have saved them a whole lot of money by not going to college. We heard her in one of the clips earlier. Tell us more about her and if her story differs greatly from the majority of the women you spoke with.
Gee, I don't think it varies. Well, it varies to some degree because most of the women we interviewed did get married, but some didn't. Some chose career. Others got married later. The woman in the movie who's just gotten the Presidential Medal of Science decided to get married later and regretted not having children. She did ultimately have a marriage, but not children. So those decisions were never easy, never simple, and never without pain for these women.
Yeah. Women graduating from college in 1969, now turning 65, a milestone of sorts. Perhaps by this point in life, there's less pressure and more time for reflection. We have a clip from the film that speaks to that.
I feel much more that I understand what the word freedom means now than then. So in some ways, I guess maybe I'm really living the 60s. Not only am I in my 60s, but I'm living the spirit of the 60s of not feeling bound by convention as much as by my own heart. And if freedom was what the 60s were about, I think I'm finally getting it.
She sums it up pretty well there, living the spirit of the 1960s once reaching 60. Liz, do you have a similar sentiment?
I definitely do. I think she pretty much summed it up and made the point that it is a continuing quest, not for answers, but to raise the right questions and then to reflect upon those questions so that one's life is richer and fuller.
Hmm. Final thought, Peter?
I think what makes this movie particularly interesting this year is the fact that Hillary Clinton is also the class of 1969, but at another college. So she's going to be raising issues about leadership, about women's roles, about prejudice against women that will resonate for some time to come if she gets elected president for a bunch of years.
Yeah.
But even if she doesn't, those issues are going to be very much in the forefront this year.
We'll have screening information for Women of 69 Unboxed and all the films we discussed this hour that are part of the Woods Hole Film Festival at our website, capeandislands.org. Liz Roman-Galise and Peter Barton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.